The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I love coming here. So I often, and I have to say I've done it more than once, but ask people to raise their hands if they don't know my parents. Just to, and usually that's like one hand in the back. So thank you so much for making the considerable effort to come out tonight. Because we have a lot of competing demands on our time and attention now as never before. So I'm going to talk to you pretty informally about this book. This is really the first time I've spoken about the book, so please bear with me as I figure out what is most compelling. But I think I have a sense of how to guide you guys from where I began 7 years ago, which, interesting, I hadn't thought about that. These books take a long time. And thank you to everyone who patiently awaits me to struggle through them, because they are a struggle and they are a hugely collective effort. So this really is a book about citizen heroes in Trump's America, which, to be really honest, is not what I intended to write. Because when I started writing this book, Trump was yet a figment of our imagination, of our future. And I really came to this book, oddly, by way of Nigeria. So some years ago when I was reporting my first book, I was in northern Nigeria when a bridge collapsed, and I had to reach this little Islamic kingdom in the north, and even without the bridge, I had to try to get there. So I was traveling, as you do, on an empty oil barrel, being dragged by some kids across a river. And it was a couple of weeks after I-35 West had collapsed in Minneapolis, and 13 people had been killed. And in Nigeria, two people had lost their lives. And there was something about that parallel that made me think something I've been thinking for a while, which is it's time to return to the United States, to look at the trouble in America, to look at the underreported problems that we have here. And I was most interested in telling a story not really of individual trouble, but of collective trouble, of collective poverty. How do we tell these harder-to-see stories about what we're not investing in and about how that plagues us all? So I thought, okay, well, the way I'm going to try to tell this story is a crumbling bridge. I'm going to find out where in the United States the highest statistic number of structurally deficient bridges are, and I'm going to set myself there, and instead of traveling over two continents and nine countries and thousands of miles, I'm going to put myself in the smallest geographic location I possibly can, because that's going to be much easier. No. So I looked at some statistics, and statistically, the highest number of struggling bridges in America are in southwestern Pennsylvania. And that has to do with reasons of, you know, industrial boom and bust, of climate change and how it impacts infrastructure, and of its particular geography. So I set out for western Pennsylvania, and looking at bridges, and I can tell you some very patient engineers put up with questions from a poet that were so ridiculous. I mean, I would wear a hard hat and one of those flasher vests and be like, is that an I-beam? It was trying for all of us. But in the course of that reporting and looking at what are these, we call them lifeline systems, what are these systems that we all rely on and rarely think about? In addition to bridges, I was looking at locks and levees and dams. And I met an incredible biologist with the Army Corps of Engineers named Rose Riley, who reminds me to this day so much of Rachel Carson, the author of Silent Spring. And Rachel Carson came from this area. So one day, Rose Riley said, I want you to come with me. I have to go to a community meeting of people who live in this watershed that stretches between southwestern Pennsylvania and West Virginia, really where Appalachia begins. Because she was thinking about systems, and she was thinking about how water moves and how water in a watershed impacts people. And We were just hearing about fracking. We had just started to hear about this oil and gas boom that had returned to the area. And since it was really just beginning at that time, people were just beginning to experience its effects firsthand. So she said she wanted to go hear what people had to say about living next door to fracking. And I said, okay, well, I'll come along. And as we drove, you know, the landscape of southwestern Pennsylvania, we drove down from Pittsburgh to West Virginia, you know, there were mountains just flatlined. I mean, the legacy of resource extraction is just written on that landscape, because flatlined mountains are, of course, mountaintop removal, where coal mines have come in and taken the entire top off a mountain. So she pointed some of these things out to me, and when we got to the airport, it was packed, and it was packed with farmers. And in western Pennsylvania, and this is a farmer is usually quite off. A farmer must have two jobs, and lots of these cattle farmers primarily had been either steel workers or coal miners. And they were packed in this little airport in the arrivals and departures lounge. And as we were sitting there, a woman got up, and she was incredibly nervous. She was sitting in front of me before she began to speak, and I could see she was with her daughter, who I took to be about 11 years old. And the daughter was hungry and grumbling, and her mom was, you know, scolding her for not eating that morning. And the daughter was still in her pajamas. And I offered the little girl a power bar. She looked at with contempt and turned around again. So this woman got up and she told her story. And she said, my name is Stacy Haney, and I am a single mother of two, and I'm a nurse at your neighborhood hospital. And my kids have benzene and toluene in their blood, we've recently discovered, and my son has arsenic poisoning. In the past few months, we've found out that there is a massive industrial waste pond about a quarter of a mile from our house. We think it might be impacting our water and our air. We don't know. And she told her story, and she told what she didn't know, and she sat down, and she started crying. She hadn't spoken, I learned later, in public since she'd played Betsy Ross in the third grade play. So she was nervous. And I went up to her afterwards, and she, you know, Stacy does not want to speak to outsiders. She is not looking to become sort of some poster child for any political cause, nor is she very interested in the press. But because I was there with no agenda and with a longer term, can I come out and talk to you and come to your house in this town of Amity? Can I come to your farm? She said, sure. So that began in March 2011, a 7-year process of her uncovering what was happening to her and her kids. You know, she didn't have lawyers when I first met her. She didn't know what to do. She didn't know where to turn. And eventually, she ended up taking on not only the company that she believed had sickened her and her kids and poisoned her land. She ended up abandoning her farm that had been in her family for more than a century. She also took on the government. Because one of the biggest failures in Pennsylvania and beyond, both on a state and then on a federal level, is the failure to regulate. And this was another form, as I learned and began to do this reporting, of public poverty. And here, in an audience of Pennsylvanians, we can talk a little bit about, you know, this began under Ed Rendell with a budget shortfall. Rendell ended up leasing hundreds of thousands of acres of public land to oil and gas interests in order to plug this hole in the budget. And over time, it's not a Democrat problem. It's not a Republican problem. We can talk about it a little bit more in questions. But we have this system in which our regulators are underfunded and understaffed. And quite often, there's a revolving door that State Impact, the NPR station in southwestern Pennsylvania, has done excellent work on tracing the revolving door between public service and private industry. So one of the people in the book was actually standing there trying to get some answers about what was going on with her water and the air when she heard the DEP, the Department of Environmental Protection employee, turn to the oil and gas employee and ask if there were jobs available. So that's just a tiny moment in the story. But I want to back up for a minute, because so much of what I came to discover in this book is now in our headlines, but not in a very profound way. And if this book does anything, in addition to carefully telling the story of these people who live in harm's way, I hope that it helps decode and complicate a little bit of our understanding of the rural-urban divide. So I'm going to open my book because I wrote some notes scribbling upstairs to make sure that I got to this. So essentially, this book traces winners and losers and people with long-standing ire toward places like Philadelphia. When I first showed up in Amity, I went to a farmer who unfortunately is no longer alive. He was the local barber, and he ran his barber shop off of his family farm, which was owned by the coal company, and his son worked in the oil and gas industry. And he said to me, "Well, where are you from?" And I knew New York City was not a good answer to this question. So I said, "Well, I'm from New York City, but I live in New York City, but I'm from Philadelphia," assuming that our Philadelphia, our Pennsylvania bond would, you know, save the day. And he just looked at me and said, "That's two strikes against you." So I started doing some digging into what are the historical roots. You know, some of these words have become such hot button convenient words: hillbilly, urban rural divide, as I'm saying. You know, what's behind it? And as I started to trace in Pennsylvania alone, you know, we really have the story of the roots of this divide here in our Commonwealth. Centuries ago, really before the Revolutionary War, Pennsylvania's Quaker elite, Philadelphia's Quaker elite, when Scots-Irish settlers began to arrive looking for land, the Quakers and others sent them west to become a buffer along the western frontier, along the Allegheny Mountains. And there, they, in order to have rights to squat on land, what they called tomahawk rights, which meant carving your initials in trees, in order to have those rights, they fought Native Americans. And the Quaker elite looked down on that, thinking, "You guys are bloody, you know, you're bloodthirsty, terrible, warring people." And so began this ire and this sense of disenfranchisement by settlers who had traveled west and said, "How, you hypocrites, we are safeguarding you, and you have sent us west to fight." And it was so bad, this tension between the colonial eastern government and the western settlers, that actually William Penn's grandson, who was governor of Pennsylvania, set an edict down that sentenced settlers to death if they refused to leave Native American land. And recently, I was at the Museum of the American Revolution here in Pennsylvania, and I have to say, with my five-year-old, walking him through those exhibits, particularly the room that talks about the Native American divide during the American Revolution and who sided with whom and why, I just thought, this is such an incredible lesson to be teaching. This is not a lesson that I grew up learning, and to think that our children are learning that now is really quite a gift, and it's remarkable. So I just wanted to call that out. So of course, over time, after the Revolutionary War, these patterns between, you know, rural and urban, we could say, settlers and settled, farmers and educated elite, became much more bloody, as actually we had a time where Western settlers actually marched on Philadelphia, the Paxton Boys, and tried to seize power, saying, "You have to protect us from Native Americans." And after the Revolution, so the settlers fought in the Revolution, went home to their homesteads in the West. Native Americans had destroyed those homesteads, and they never received their salaries as soldiers in the colonial effort in the Revolutionary War. Becoming enraged about that, when in one of his less laudable moments, Andrew Hamilton passed a tax on their most lucrative asset, which was their whiskey, was the first federal excise tax. The people in where I was working in Washington County rose up against the federal government for the first time and said, "You rapacious outsider, you will not seize our most lucrative asset here in western Pennsylvania. And they tarred and feathered tax collectors, much as revolutionary soldiers had tarred and feathered agents of the crown. And they rose up. And they rose up against the federal government, and it's the first time ever that we've had a president lead troops against people in our own nation, because George Washington marched west to quell this rebellion. I could go on about this history. I love it. It's fascinating, but I'm going to try to skip over a couple hundred years and just say, when you drive down Main Street in Washington County, where I've worked for 7 years, and you peek in the window of the Mingo Creek Distillery, you will see the portrait of Alexander Hamilton hanging upside down, just to signal a nice F you to the federal government that continues to this day. So this question of who pays the cost of American energy is alive and well in the towns of Amity and Prosperity, Pennsylvania. And that, I think, for me, is what I discovered more than anything as I went to do this reporting. That, you know, that is really a major source of the ire in rural America today, in places like Appalachia, where energy is produced. You know, to see city dwellers as people who don't know what it costs to flick on their lights. You know, I wrote this past weekend in the New York Times about the president of the Pork Association in Washington County, who is always telling me that I'm a hypocrite. You urban Americans are hypocrites. You want to come here and shake your fingers at us and say, don't you dare lease your minerals because you're doing something dirty to the earth? This is the first time in history we stand a chance to make any money at all from the minerals that have been stolen from us for centuries. So don't come here and tell me what to do with my land. And if I hope that the book restores that understanding of a sophisticated level of, these are people who for centuries have signed mineral leases, for centuries have watched coal companies come and go, pass on their costs, leave economic and social costs as companies go bankrupt. These are people who understand the patterns of industry and have much to tell us about them. And for one, I really felt that my job more than anything was just to shut up and listen. So at the same time, this is really a story that reads like a story. And it is a story about this family of Stacey Haney and her kids. So I am going to read you guys the beginning of the book and see how it reads. And it's going to come up with some questions, because the book revolves around the county fair. Because the county fair is the biggest thing going in Washington County. It's more than 200 years old, and Stacy and her kids have shown animals there from the time her kids could walk, they were showing animals. And Stacy, just one other note that's important to understand, she and her family have lived this legacy of resource extraction. Her dad is an out-of-work steelworker. He's also a Vietnam combat veteran, like many of the men who live around her area. And when the steel mill shut down, her mom went to work for the first time out of the house, like a whole generation of women from Amity, Pennsylvania. Mostly they became housekeepers. So the idea of living the cycles of boom and bust of American energy are very, very present and very they're very immediate in people's lives. And so the idea that Washington, D.C. energy policy is remote or, you know, not comprehensive, people understand in Amity and Pennsylvania a very different lived reality. So with that, I'm going to read you the beginning of the book. That was a lot of information. Thank you for sticking with me. Okay. So as I said, the book begins and ends at this Washington County Fair, which if you ever get the chance to go, it's pretty remarkable. It's a pretty remarkable place. So Fair 2010. Most years at the Washington County Fair, Stacy Haney set up an animal salon outside her blue and white coachman trailer. She and her younger sister Shelley would plug a blow dryer into a generator and style their children's goats in preparation for 4-H competition. This year, the salon seemed too much effort, so Stacy readied the animals at home. She'd spent the past 2 days up to her armpits in a blue kiddie pool of freezing water and mane and tail soap, washing, clipping, and brushing 2 goats, 2 pigs, and 4 rabbits. Then that August morning, she'd hauled them 10 miles to the fairgrounds. After registering the rabbits, she proceeded to Cowley's lemonade stand with her 11-year-old daughter, Paige. 30 miles southwest of Pittsburgh, the Washington County Fairground was composed of 2 worlds. The lower realm contained a tilt-a-whirl operated by strangers, roustabouts who arrived from elsewhere. Stacy's son, Harley, who just turned 14, called it Carney Land. The upper belonged to 4-H and agriculture, ag types, many of whom, including Stacy's family, considered themselves Hoopies, an insider's name for the Hilljacks or Hillbillies, who lived in the borderlands of Pennsylvania, Ohio, and West Virginia, where Appalachia begins. These 2 worlds met midway up the ridge at Cowley's, where Stacy and Paige were waiting for lemonade, when they spied 2 familiar figures trundling downhill from the horse barn. The square woman with frosted hair and the spare man with a snowy mane and a limp were Beth and John Voiles. They lived next door at Just a Breeze, a 15-acre farm where they trained horses and bred high-end dogs. The 2 families shared a fence and a love of animals. Beth treated her boxers like children. She cooked them angel hair pasta, zucchini, and meatball sandwiches, and dressed them in tiny leather jackets, flight goggles, and scarves for professional photographs. She framed the photographs and hung them around the ranch house where she'd lived with John for the past 28 years. Say what one might about the Voiles, over the past year and a half, they'd proven excellent neighbors. While Stacy, 40, juggled full-time shifts as a nurse in the recovery unit of the Washington Hospital and finalized her divorce from Larry Haney, the Voiles kept a quiet eye on her place. Their daughter, Ashley, often brought her new boxer puppy, Cummins, down to distract Harley when he was sick at home. At 22, Ashley still lived at home and raced horses professionally. She'd also been teaching Paige to ride since Paige was 2. As Beth and John approached, Stacy could see that mascara was running down Beth's ruddy face. She guessed it was the muggy heat. The air at the fair was redolent with popcorn and musk, which mingled with the scent of baby shampoo from the mane and tail lingering on Stacy's arm. A rash blazed on Stacy's left arm, where it had been erupting on and off for months. Although she was a nurse, she couldn't determine its cause. She studied the welts, and when she looked up, Beth was in front of her, her face smeared with tears. "Cummins is dead," Beth said. "Poisoned." Stacy's head swam. In her mind, she scanned the farmhouses and trailers that wended their way from the top of the valley where she and Beth lived, down McAdams Road to the base of the hollow called the Bottoms. She knew nearly everyone. Many families were bound by generations of helping one another farm and, more recently, survive the economic collapse of the past several decades. "No one would poison a puppy," she told Beth gently. Beth thought otherwise. The vet had told her that Cummins' insides had frozen up, she said, crystallized, as if he'd drunk antifreeze. The vet couldn't rule out cancer either, but Beth suspected foul play. She also thought she knew where the poison had come from. She'd seen the dog drinking from a puddle of water left on the roadside after a truck came through to spray down dust earlier that summer. Wondering what the liquid was, she'd tried to follow with a glass mason jar, but the driver stopped. Screeching his air brake on the steep dirt hill, he yelled at her to back away. Later, Beth and Stacy would mark this conversation about Cummins' death as the beginning of solving a mystery. But at the time, Stacy was sweaty and distracted. Paige stood by, crunching the sugar at the bottom of her lemonade cup. Stacy hugged Beth and watched her continue down the hill with John toward the field of neon. She wanted to get back to the trailer to check on Harley. She dreaded telling him the news. Harley loved Cummins, and he was so sick. Over the past year and a half, his stomach had churned with an undiagnosed illness. He'd missed most of 7th grade, sitting at home in a recliner watching his dog, Hunter, play with Cummins on the living room floor. Harley had gone from being a shy and handsome basketball player who shambled easily through life to a listless stick figure. At 6'1", he was 127 pounds. A few days earlier, when Harley weighed his goat boots for competition at the fair, she'd weighed nearly the same as her master. Stacy hoped that this year's 4-H competition would lift his spirits. She and Harley had ambitions for Boots. Instead of being skittish, as most goats are, Boots was friendly. Harley spent every day with her since he was home, which may have been why the brown and white boar goat enjoyed people. When Harley went up to the Haney's ramshackle barn to feed her, Boots slung her hooves over the wooden pen to lick his face. Okay, I'm going to stop reading there. So, it's hard to read, and because in many ways the story isn't over. And from there unfolds a tale that really begins with the sickening of animals, of how Stacy and her neighbor Beth Voiles began to put together what was happening, what they believe was happening, which the gas company continues to contest to this day, even though the case has been settled. So I can talk more about the story. Basically, the story is driven by what happened to these families. We sometimes talk in narrative nonfiction about a foreground narrative and a background narrative. So the foreground narrative here is the story of Stacy Haney and her kids, but the background narrative is a century of resource extraction and why it is that here in America, often we look abroad for something we call the resource curse. It's a term we economists have been using since the 90s that explains why it is that people who live on land richest in natural resources tend to be among the poorest. And the truth is, the resource curse applies to America as well, and nowhere more so than Appalachia. And what I hope I've done through a careful accounting of both sides, because there are people who really support fracking and have benefited from the money, right next door to Stacy and her neighbors, and they are in the book as well. Hopefully what I've done is a careful accounting of the resource curse and how those dynamics feed into this rural-urban divide that we really have to do a better job at understanding. So thank you. Okay, with that, we're going to open it up for some questions.
I can't wait to read it.
Thank you.
I heard the beginning. That's wonderful. As it became known what you were writing mm-hmm. about, what kind of reactions were you getting in the community or from the industry, mm-hmm. from the people? Did you encounter any resistance?
Quite a bit of it, and that's a great question. This is a particular kind of reporting called immersion reporting, which is not for the faint of heart, because you show up and you're so intimate in people's lives over a period of time. And through that process, there's a great deal of accountability. And I really am indebted to both Jason Clark, the president of the Pork Association, and he keeps his pigs on a farm of a man named Ray Day. And Ray has had his family farm for as long as Stacy Haney. He has a few hundred acres with his family. He has made enough money off of fracking to, build a barn, get new tractors in the farm, build a bathroom for his mom before she died on the first floor of her house so that she didn't have to leave the house. He has an incredibly positive experience of what fracking has brought to the community. And he knew what I was doing, and very patiently, time and again, he would say funny things that were wonderful. Like, I would always be throwing around the New York Times. Well, I'm writing this for the New York Times. And he would just say, "We don't read the New York Times around here." And he also said, when I first showed up at his farm, "You haven't asked me what I do for a job." And I said, "Well, you're a farmer." He said, "No farmer has one job. I was a middle school science teacher for 30 years. So again and again, the process of discovery was humbling. And if this book has done its job, it's done its job by Ray Day as much as it's done its job by Stacy Haney.
Thanks for writing the book and sharing it with us. Based on your interactions, and we've got elections coming up, and you talked about regulation, what one or two things would you suggest that we in Pennsylvania should focus on in terms of trying to bridge the rural-urban divide?
That's a great question. I've been out in out in Pittsburgh, really covering Democratic primaries, and watching some fantastic young candidates come up. I was hoping one would be here tonight. She's from Philadelphia. Elizabeth Fiedler is her name. And watching the divide within the Democratic Party over, you know, those who believe in a more different factions within the Democratic Party. And I would say, you know, the days of voting along party lines and thinking one party or another is going to fix it in whatever terms we think fixing is, those days are over. And we have an obligation to do our homework more carefully, and certainly to put into government people who have an understanding that public systems are valuable. Now, I will tell you right now that if Ray Day were standing up here and he heard me say we need to strengthen regulation, he would roll his eyes at the least. Because for many small farmers in southwestern Pennsylvania, the experience of regulation has been impoverishment. Farm regulation has meant, for instance, Jason, the pork farmer, for him to have, he has these pigs. And his pigs, when they need a shot, according to regulation, a vet has to come out to the farm and administer that shot. That costs $100, right? You cannot drive your tractor through a stream. Your stream has to be fenced so that your cows can't get in it. And yet, a fracker can show up, and where are the regulations that apply to him? So these are complicated issues, how regulations are actually implemented, but I would say we have to really address in Pennsylvania, especially our public poverty when it comes to the Department of Environmental Protection, because it has been thoroughly gutted. Again, that is not a Democrat issue. It's not a Republican issue. But if we want to, Pennsylvania has a law on its books that actually serves as one of the great wins in the book. And that law is in the Bill of Rights. It's Article 27 that allows for Pennsylvanians to have the right to clean air and pure water. It's a really unusual environmental rights amendment in our state constitution. And through the court, the amazing lawyers who end up supporting Stacey and her family take that amendment, along with Jordan Yeager, who's a Bucks County lawyer. They take that amendment all the way up to the state Supreme Court to a conservative Republican justice, Ron Castile, who has since retired. And Ron Castile, who is also a Vietnam combat vet, he upholds that right in Pennsylvania for the first time in history. So I think understanding what our laws allow for, working not even across the aisle, but with like-minded. I mean, a lot of the people who are most staunchly opposed to fracking in this book are not Democrats. They are conservationists. They don't like the word environmentalist. They think that word comes with a liberal agenda. They trace their lineage back and their beliefs to Teddy Roosevelt. And they believe in defending and protecting our natural resources for wise use by the next generation, not as some kind of pristine wilderness. And they also, of course, tend to be those who have been steel workers and coal miners and seen firsthand what happens. So again, I hope that the book complicates easy notions of I am so tired and worked really hard to make sure that this book didn't become one more political football for people to throw at one another, because fracking has become one of those issues that nobody really knows much about, but if you sit on one side or the other, you sure are going to have some opinions. So if it does anything, it is to carefully undo some of those expectations, and I hope I answered your question.
You indicate there are many sides to the issue, probably, and maybe you've just taken an economic perspective. Mm-hmm. But I would say that I would refer you to your experiences traveling with the warlord, as you described in the New Yorker magazine so successfully in very, very good detail.
Which warlord? I've lost track.
the other thing is, a lot of these issues, as a poet, you could put in poetic perspective and get to the essence or the soul of the problem that you did so successfully in Wide Awake Field. So I would say that that kind of solution might be a different perspective than just taking one side or the other side. So I'm encouraging you to revisit the thing or describe how your book indicates how you rode with danger with a warlord that indicated any perspective, or is there any poetic solution to any of the sides?
Well, the closest we get to a warlord here is the president of the Pork Association in Washington County, who, you know, has on the back of his pickup truck, you know, Hillary lied and, you know, Benghazi soldiers died bumper sticker. I mean, these are people with very different understandings of what fact means in our time. I am consistently interested in the human impact of problems, right? So as I go around and start talking about this book and deal with some of the ongoing pushback from the oil and gas company, part of that question, is there an economic reality that is divorced from the social or human impact? I don't think so. You know, one of the things that Rachel Carson did so – what Rachel Carson did in Silent Spring, she all she did is trace the practical reality of the food chain, which we at the time didn't understand at all. We didn't understand that when the fish eats the fly and then we eat the fish, whatever's in the fly is going to pass to us. It's just practical. She was a conservationist, writing about intertwined systems. And I think that idea of an intertwined system, how it is that the air and water doesn't just impact this family, but what happens to the family impacts the community. And what happens to the community impacts the rest of us. Hopefully that complex understanding of systems is throughout this book.
I might be asking the impossible, but as you put, Rachel Carson was able to make that line very clear. Is there a way to nutshell the science of how you, the idea of fracking turns into illness for the residents? Can you draw that line?
I can draw a line of putting any industrial site within 800 feet of somebody's house is a recipe for disaster. What first sickens the people in this book, as they believe, is 200 diesel trucks passing their house 35 feet from them. Their house sat 35 feet from a dirt road, and 200 trucks were going up and down that road every day. The goats started coughing, the kids started coughing, and their understanding, and causal links are incredibly difficult to make, and I'm very careful with them, their understanding is that the particles from diesel particulate matter began to lodge in their respiratory systems. So even before we get to fracking itself, you cannot put an industrial site, whatever that industrial site is, so close to people. That's one of the differences. In addition, Pennsylvania's geology is very different from the geology of, say, Texas, right? So what happened is that drillers showed up in Pennsylvania and tried to use some of the methods they'd used in Texas, particularly to store waste, and those methods were impossible. So another problem that's documented here is the use of these waste ponds, these surface, you could call them frack ponds. It's the storage of the fluid and flowback, the waste used in fracking, both that can be reused. When they say they recycle 100% of the fluid used in fracking, often in between fracks, that fluid is stored in an open pond. And in this case, the pond was lined with two garbage bag liners, thicker than garbage bags, but that's the idea. The leak detection system was installed improperly. There was no way to know that the ponds were leaking, although the DEP found in several notice of violations the ponds were leaking. There's no law on the books that says you have to notify people nearby if a frack pond is leaking hundreds of feet from their home. And one of the issues that Pennsylvania has in particular is this question of private water. Because one thing people have asked me already, and that Stacy and her family were asking, especially as the Flint, Michigan story broke, is why are we not Flint? And the answer is pretty simple. Because in the course of the book, the FBI comes in to launch a couple of investigations, and they're unable to make anything stick. And the reasons are, first of all, legislation, statutes are different because these people aren't on public water. They're on private well water, which is not regulated in Pennsylvania. Furthermore, they're just a handful of them in a rural area. And that is a lot harder of a news story to rest public outrage on.
Hi, thanks so much. Based on what you've seen in coal country Pennsylvania that's now frack country, how would you respond to centrists, including someone like Joe Nocera at the New York Times, who talk about fracking as an environmental lesser of two evils because it's displacing coal And therefore, even though there are issues and under regulation, that it's doing some environmental good because the coal extraction and coal burning is worse.
So one of probably my favorite my favorite lesson from reporting this book was in talking to energy analysts, particularly those at Citibank, who explained to me that the idea – so the Obama administration made a great deal of natural gas as a bridge fuel, right? We needed to get from coal and dirtier fossil fuels to renewables. We had to rely on natural gas as a bridge fuel. Well, the idea is has not held up. And the reason is that has nothing to do with hand-wringing environmental anything. It has to do with energy markets, because the fastest growth in energy markets is in renewables. So if you're, you know, there's a terrific energy analyst who spells things out pretty simply for me because I need him to do that. And he just says, look, if you're an investor right now, you're looking to put your money in, you know, in electricity, in an electric plant, you're never going to invest in natural gas, right? You don't even know 40 years from now, is a plant going to be using natural gas? No, you're going to go, where is the sure growth? The sure growth is what's called off-grid. It's wind and it's solar. Right, that's where the market is growing fastest. And we don't need, I mean, a lot of the thinking was what government subsidies. Well, are government subsidies, you know, backing up the renewables market? Clearly not now. And still that segment of the energy market is growing fastest. So I would say to Jonah Sarah, and God knows I'll probably have to say this to Jonah Sarah at some point, that I think it's short-sighted. I think it's yesterday's news. But not based on some kind of finger wagging and we need to be better, not any kind of should, but the hard practical reality of where growth is in our markets.
Would you say that there's much conversation going on about correcting the areas where fracking's taking place? In other words, are the families finding that the industries that come in, are they correcting the fracking sites? And also, too, is there a tax at this point in Pennsylvania to actually tax the people that actually come in and do the fracking so that there's money for repair?
Yep. So those are great questions. So in my experience of it, okay, so there are certain methods and really shoddy methods used in the course of this book that the company itself is trying to no longer use. Like those frack ponds, there are still a couple left in Washington County, but the DEP really as a result of the case that was ongoing with Stacy and her family, it came to light that not only the waste pond next to their house was leaking, 8 other ponds were leaking in their county alone. So in that way, their case has helped bring some actual change in the implementation of the process. So are they receiving relief? Not in my experience of it. But are things changing? Yes, they are. To your second question, which had to do with extraction tax, right? So one of the things that the book traces is how, as I talked about this right to clean air and pure water, how under Governor Corbett, there was a bid to change the oil and gas law and to bring more money into communities in exchange for the communities no longer regulating. The state would regulate, but communities, which I bet you guys know, in Pennsylvania have a lot of power. You know, there are more than 2,500 municipalities, and they have the right to say lots of – they had the right to some degree control what frackers could do. You may not come on our roads at this time, just very practical rules – if not regulations. That bid lost. One of the things I would ask to the person who was asking about talking to, like, in the election, right, in these elections, what do you want to hear from these candidates? You want to hear where they stand on an extraction tax, right? This has gone nowhere in the Pennsylvania legislature for quite a while because Republicans are in control. So that is, and many Democrats also don't support it because it's a non-starter. Right, so that's something that one could look further into in when you vote. Where does my candidate stand on the issue of taxation of oil and gas?
I've just wondered if the farmer who was making money off of fracking knew that his neighbor was getting sick off of his making the money. And how did he feel about that? Was there any exchange or any feeling back and forth?
There's quite a bit of feeling back and forth. He does not believe that the neighbors are sick from fracking. He thinks they're looking for a payday with this lawsuit. And his pond, the pond on his farm, leaked also. But again, with his understanding of regulation, he's like, you know what? I'd rather have the company in here than the federal government, because at least the company came and told me that my pond had leaked. Now, how long it took the company to tell him that the pond had leaked, what happened, what water his cows drank in the interim, all of those questions are unanswered. But he would dispute, if he were standing here, that the family's sicknesses came from the presence of oil and gas next to their house. It's a very live issue in the town, and I am looking forward with great interest to returning to the town next week. Because one of the things I did, which I don't know, it's so intimate, this book, and it's so fraught, and with Stacy in particular. So a couple of weeks before the book went to press, the company decided to settle the case. Okay, I don't know the terms of the settlement. They are confidential, as most legal settlements are. I can tell you, I can report on how the people feel about them, and they feel pretty badly about that settlement. And as part of it, they are not going to talk to you about this book. They're not allowed to. So the book has become a secret history of sorts of what happened to them. But there's a huge obligation. You know, I mean, this is not just a mom. This is two kids. And I showed up over 7 years in their lives at unexpected times. And lots of times, it wasn't so much fun to have a reporter around. So when I had the manuscript quite late in the game, I decided that it was my responsibility, and they don't come off so well. It's not like, here are our shining, you know, they're human beings like the rest of us. So I actually drove down to Washington. I drove down to Amity, the town of Amity in Washington County, and I sat at Stacy's kitchen table face to face, and I read her the entire book. Because I figured if I didn't have the courage to show up and read her what I had seen and how I'd interpreted it over 7 years, I had no business reporting this book.
Your comment actually about Stacy has now signed her legal right to speak about this issue, and the whole concept of non-disclosure agreements that is rife throughout the entire fracking world is very important to me. As a physician, I believe that the reason why we don't know about the health effects of fracking is because all these people are signing non-disclosure agreements, and they've been prohibited from talking to health researchers about all these health effects. And so the public has this, you know, belief that this is safe and that it can be done with our environmental regulations. When if you think about it logically, pouring all these toxic chemicals in the ground is almost for sure a recipe for disaster.
That is so well said. A part of the case that Stacy takes with her lawyers all the way up to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court was that amended oil and gas law, Act 13. And part of what Governor Corbett wanted to do is put something in place called a physician gag rule. And that would have meant that any physician who treated somebody sick from chemicals, possible chemical exposure to fracking, would be able to find out from the company what constituents had been used, but would never be allowed to tell another physician or the patient him or herself. Because, and the understanding was, those are proprietary secrets. Like it or not, that law was struck down as a product of John and Kendra Smith, who are the attorneys in this book, as a product of their work. Now, John and Kendra Smith their little firm set in South Point, Pennsylvania, which is the capital of oil and gas development in western Pennsylvania. They were making a lot of money off of helping people negotiate oil and gas leases. Kendra's background, what she does now on a daily basis, she's a corporate defense attorney for railroads in asbestos cases. She is no shrinking violet, right? When she began her career, she mostly represented the mafia, and she's a former finalist for Miss New Jersey. She's amazing. She's amazing. She and her husband really began as pro-industry. You know, they really assumed that the regulatory bodies were in charge of had it under control, and God knows Southwestern Pennsylvania needed the money, right? So It was only in the course of working with Stacy and her neighbors that they understood how woefully inadequate both state and federal regulation was in terms of fracking, and that's really why they stood up. So thank you so much for pointing out that position, and that is one of the issues about physicians today that really has to be looked at.
Thanks for a wonderful talk. My family has actually lived in the same county in the northern panhandle of West Virginia since 1831.
Wow.
And by the way, we're called Hoopies because we made the barrel hoops that went around the whiskey barrels.
Totally.
In Wheeling and Wellsburg and Follansbee, West Virginia. But I'm wondering, as you did your research, did you discover the decades-old graft that has gone on with this business of regulation? I actually left West Virginia in 1980. But I remember that the coal company, whose name I will not give, was actually hiring chemistry majors from my college. And what they were doing is they would know when the EPA was coming around to check the runoff from strip mining, and that was acid runoff. And they actually would hire the chemistry majors once a month to go and put extra base in the water so that the water would pass. And this was, you know, a pretty decent job for a chemistry major coming out of college. So I think what you're discovering with the looking in the opposite direction on regulation and fracking is really just a decades, well, probably a century old of graft and being the industry buying off any kind of regulation.
That's absolutely right to the core. And the book is named for two towns. So Stacy and her family live in Amity, but they're from Prosperity, which is about 10 miles away. And Prosperity is in many ways a ghost town. I wish we had some people from Prosperity here who could talk about it. Why? Because industrial mining has come underneath it and taken out all the coal. And with that industrial mining, so too water disappears. So farms have been dewatered. It's literally called being undermined. And what I hope the story does, it tells those layers of extraction. I mean, I'll tell you the first sentence of the I read you the beginning of the sort of narrative portion, but the first sentence of the preface is, 400 million years ago, dragonflies the size of crows drifted above a giant inland sea, right? And that tells the story of how carbon was laid down over millennia and how the harvest of carbon happens in the same places, right? Because the same place you're going to hit coal, you're going to hit oil and gas on top and below it. So thank you for pointing that out. There's a remarkable book by Henry Caudill who Night Comes to the Cumberlands. And that is really, it's out of print, and I came across it in the course of this reporting. And it's, if anyone wants to read a definitive account of how coal mining has entered Appalachia, what has happened, that really is the book to read.
You've implied somewhat that it's not just fracking that's done this poisoning of the soil and the water, that it goes back. You've suggested oil, coal, the shearing off of the mountains. Is it that fracking is so much worse, or has this poisoning of the landscape been going on ever since industrialization began?
So I hope I've done more than imply, but I've made it quite clear that over more than a century, the history of the extraction of resources from this region has poisoned the land. That's not a metaphor. That's just a lived reality. It's not just environmental costs. It's social costs as well. Because one of the reasons we have the opioid crisis in this area in particular is that coal miners, any heavy laborer, who it can no longer work in a mine or in a steel mill, who gets injured. I mean, that's becomes hooked on opioids, and then we move to heroin. Okay, so that's just one tiny bit of some of the social costs, along with the environmental and economic costs related to industrial industry in this area. But now, let me say, is fracking worse? I don't know if that's a question we can answer. Fracking uses synthetic chemicals, and as the physician pointed out a little bit earlier, we don't know what some of the harmful effects of those chemicals are used singularly or when combined, because some of the compounds found in the water up at Stacy Haney's house, we didn't know what they were. There are no health effects on the books. So coal can be cleaned up. coal mining, acid mine drainage, you can actually clean up iron out of water. Can you clean up some of these synthetic poisonings? That we're not quite sure yet. So the verdict is out on your question. Okay, with that, we are going to wrap it up. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.